In 570, give or take a few years, a person was born in Mecca whose name is Muhammad. And the word Muhammad means praised. Muhammad. He was early orphaned. His father died before he was actually born. And his mother, Amina, which means the faithful one, died when Muhammad was only 2. And then his grandfather, who loved him very much, took care of him until he was 6, and then he died. And then an uncle took care of Muhammad up until middle age, not as a provider of food and so forth, but as a sponsor and one who gave Muhammad protection, clan protection, especially when Muhammad later, as a prophet, became quite controversial. We don't know much about Muhammad's youth, except we have legends of his proverbial reliability and good judgment in dealing with people, his wisdom. But he did become an employee of a wealthy widow who had been married twice and had children. This occurred, the birth was in 570, and by 595, because he was such a good manager of Khadija's caravan business to Syria and to Palestine, she proposed marriage. Her father was upset because she would be marrying below her station an orphan, a fine young man, but with no bride price, nothing to bring to it, no stocks and bonds or property or anything like that. But they did marry, and they had a very happy marriage, from all accounts, and they had several children. Tragically, Muhammad, with this wife, Khadija, and also with other wives that he married after her death, never had a male heir. He had daughters, but never males. And that, of course, is a tragedy in any traditional Semitic social environment. But they married, and the next we know for certain was about 610, when Muhammad was 40, and Khadija was about 55 by that time. She was 15 years older. Muhammad had taken to solitary meditation on the outskirts of Mecca in a cave in a mountainside. He was what the Quran calls a Hanif, a person who is neither a Jew nor a Christian, nor a polytheistic Arab, because Arabian religion was idolatrous. Rather, he was one who tended toward the right way, a Hanif. Abraham is called a Hanif, a pure monotheist, but not a brand name monotheist, not a Jew or a Christian or a Zoroastrian, but one who is yearning and seeking the one God. And there were a number of people who were contemplative in the Mecca of Muhammad's time because of the breakdown of the traditional tribal humanism, is what calls it, the breakdown of the moral and value system, with the coming into the economy of more and more money. More fast fortunes were being made, and more people were abandoning their traditional areas when they could and moving into Mecca because of the prosperity. But it was causing a breakdown of the kinship system and the traditional caring for the weaker people, the widow, the orphan, the outcast, the traveler. Muhammad thought a lot about this. He also was very worried about such things as increasing wife beating, battering, sexual irregularity, licentiousness, which is well documented, the exposing and burying alive of infant girls, and alcoholism, which was coming in. A real kind of anomie, a breakdown of values. So, in 610, Muhammad had been out meditating in his cave, and he received what we can call the call. A voice came to him, scaring him greatly, saying, "Recite." And according to one tradition, this man-like creature, a mysterious creature, spread a brocaded coverlet over Muhammad, who was lying in the floor of the cave, and pressed down on him painfully. And Muhammad said, depending on how you interpret the Arabic, "I cannot recite," or "I cannot read," or what shall I read, but still panicked. "Recite or read." "I cannot." "Read." "I cannot." And then finally this voice said, read or recite in the name of your Lord who created humankind of clotted blood. Recite, for your Lord is the most noble, who has taught humankind what they did not know, has taught them by the pen. These are the first words of the Quran, which starts with the word recite. And this word, I'll give it to you in Arabic, is Iqra. Iqra. Bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. Khalaq al-insan min alaq. You can get a little sense of the snap and flap of Arabic from this. The pharyngeals, the laryngeals, and the intensive dentals. Iqra, iqra, iqra. It's almost as if one is expectorating something, or at the point of birth when the passage is cleared and the baby starts to cry. You know, when the air goes into the lungs for the first time, it's a kind of a birth thing. I have not made this up. One of my Quran professors in Cairo, whom I studied under, said that this is one of the interpretations. This iqra is a kind of ejaculation. This recite or speak out. And so Muhammad had been approached by Gabriel, Angel Gabriel, in that mountainside. He went back, frightened to death, to Khadija and told her all about it. She immediately believed in her husband and said, "This is a wonderful thing." They went to a cousin who was a Christian called Waraka, and he said, "This is none other than the great Nomos, or the great Namus in Arabic, or the law, Moses. And this is the same." He saw it immediately. The old biblical characters were known in Arabia, although Christianity and Judaism had never caught on in a major way. But they were known, and travelers were there. And there were Jews in the environment, as well as some Christians. Well, it didn't come back, this voice. And Muhammad thought he was going crazy. At one point, he was going to throw himself off a pinnacle. Sounds a little bit like the story of Jesus in the temptation in the wilderness. But he thought he was going mad. But he was not. Later, the visitations come back, but not in a visual form. Muhammad is not a visual prophet, but an auditory prophet. And that's why I discussed the poetry a little bit. The people really had ears for language. And the Quran was to become regarded as the central miracle of Muhammad's prophetic career. He was often asked to perform miracles because they'd heard of Jesus performing miracles and Elijah and others as well. He said, "No, I have no miracles. The only miracle that I'm associated with is the revelation of the Quran," which is believed to have been accomplished by a process known as wahi, which can be translated as revelation, but which my former professor, Fazlur Rahman, calls idea-word inspiration. That is, Muhammad is not the composer. He is not the author of the Quran. He is the pure, the immaculate, a virgin, you might say, through whom God works in revealing his message to humankind. And he's called the Ummi Nabi, that is the pure or the unscriptured or the unlettered prophet. He could not have composed it even if he wanted to, because the tradition insists that Muhammad was illiterate. And it seems that he was. He was able to dictate what he had learned to others, and some did write it down gradually as they went on. So in 610, people in small numbers began to respond to this message, which is really the message of ethical monotheism. It's very close to the morality and the message of the Old Testament, of justice, of compassion, of historical urgency, of decision, of crisis, and of judgment. One should be grateful for the things that God has given us, and one should be aware that we have come from God, and to God we shall return. This message becomes developed through the next 12 years in Mecca. During this time, quite a few people, more than 100, will become Muslim. This becomes a cult, essentially. A cell type of religious movement, which increasingly finds itself in opposition to the oligarchy and the idolatrous establishment of Mecca, partly because Muhammad comes increasingly to criticize the immorality of the people and the idolatry of the Kaaba cult with its many gods, which was lucrative because pilgrims from all parts of Arabia would go to Mecca seasonally. They would make sacrifices, they would worship, and they would spend money there. And if Muhammad were to ruin this, he would kill the ghost, the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak. God promised Muhammad once, though, being well aware of this fear of the Meccans, that if the Meccans change their ways, you will make more than ever. Now, I'm paraphrasing crudely. It's not put exactly that way, but that's the strong implication. And of course, God fulfilled his promise, because people from all over the world go to Mecca on pilgrimage now. Sometimes 3 to 4 and more million a year from every point on the globe. In 622, because of the difficulties that the group was experiencing in Mecca, and all but one or two of the converts were from the lower levels of society, Muhammad himself was a poor member of his tribe, without a great deal of clout. They had an opportunity to move, and this is the Hijra, or the Hijra, as you may know it from school books. Hijra, which is sometimes translated flight, but should be translated emigration, of Muhammad and his followers from Mecca to Medina, a farming oasis 280 miles north. Probably a bit over 100 people moved up there. He did not order his followers to move. He invited them. Muhammad had been invited by the fathers of Medina to come and be their city manager, really an arbitrator from outside who had a reputation for fairness and balance, because in Medina there were some deadly, serious factions fighting against each other for land and for water and for influence. A sizable Jewish community was caught between two warring Arab factions. There had been Jews there for a long time, and they had actually developed the oasis. So Muhammad did go, but he insisted before going, and he got a covenant agreed to, that they should become Muslims, they should submit to God, and that they should obey Muhammad as their prophet. This later was formalized in what we now call the Constitution of Medina. Medina, by the way, means city. The original name for the oasis community was Yathrib. But later, because of the Prophet's association, it comes to be called the City of the Prophet, or just the City, which is Al-Madina, the city. The word Medina is encountered all over the Middle East. If you ask for the Medina, you're really asking for downtown, that sort of thing. The Medina is where the town hall is, the courthouse, and so on and so forth. So, in 622, the Ummah was founded. You see, it had only been a cult and a very small, weak minority in Mecca, but here the whole community was organized along the lines of theocracy. God was believed ideally to be the king, but Muhammad was his messenger and his executive. And so the Ummah means community. It means a religious community. But in typically Islamic terms, religion is both faith and order. That is, both religious system and government. Islam is a complete way of life. There is no distinction made between religious and secular. There's always a distinction made between sacred and profane. That's not the same thing. Or pure and impure. But there's no distinction made between what is religious as being over here and what is secular or civil or civic as being over there. It all must be one, because it must reflect the unity of God. Over the years in Medina, there were ups and downs, but more often than not, an increasing sense that God is with us And up until 632, Muhammad succeeded in finally uniting all of Arabia under the banner of the new religion of Islam, the restoration of the primordial monotheism of Abraham. And there was a strong sense that the Christians and the Jews would someday come to realize that reconciliation was essential and that the religion of all of God's people should be one. Jews and Christians, from the time of Muhammad and the Quran, are known as the people of the book, people of the Bible, and they are to be honored and respected and not forced into the new religion. They are to realize their inferior status, however, and they are to be under Islamic hegemony. Now, the Quran and Muhammad are so intimately involved with each other because the Quran is cumulatively revealed during all of this period. When Muhammad died in 632, Mecca had been reconciled. There had been terrible battles between the Meccan pagan polytheists and the Muslims of Medina. And finally, when Muhammad was strong enough, he took many thousands of troops and marched south to Medina, surrounded the city, and was on the verge of storming it in a bloody Armageddon when he finally relented because he had Hilm. And the people called him Halim because his God is Halim. And he did the stronger thing, he forgave them. And they all became Muslims in one day. So here we have a person who was really a statesman, you see. He's so different from Jesus. I mean, they're both great in their own ways, but Muhammad was a man of affairs and a man of military ability, a poet in his own way, a mystic, a wonderful father and husband, and apparently an enormously energetic male. He had great tact. He loved women in a way that other men didn't. And I do not mean that in an unworthy sense. Women loved him because he listened to them. And he loved to be with them, to sit with them, and to just enjoy their presence. There is a saying that Muhammad once declared, "There are three things especially wonderful and meaningful and beautiful to me: prayer, perfume, and the company of women." Omar, this is another anecdote, but Omar, who was the greatest addition to the little frail Islamic movement in Meccan days, when they tried to worship at the Kaaba, bullies from the majority would come out and throw dirt on them or excrement or innards of slaughtered beasts. Because it was thought that a real man never prostrates. A real Arab would never do that, but would be like a lion at the waterhole. You ever seen a predator at a waterhole? Or one of them will always be looking about like that. But nobody ever really prostrates. But Muhammad just calmly continued to lead his little group in prayer. Omar hated Muhammad right down to the core of his being. Omar was a very violent man, probably the toughest military man in Mecca, and he was on his way one day with his sword to kill Muhammad when a Muslim, unknown to Omar because he kept his Islam a secret, accosted him in the street and said, "Omar, you should settle the affairs in your own family before you go and kill Muhammad. Your sister is a Muslim. Did you know that?" And Omar didn't know that. So they went to this house where the Muslims used to gather to pray unmolested. And he heard some Arabic being intoned outside. And he went and knocked on the door and came in. And all the people were frightened because they thought Omar was going to kill them. And the sister was there. And she had a piece of parchment with Arabic writing on it, which she immediately put up under her dress and between her thighs so it couldn't be seen. And Omar said, "What was that that I heard?" And they finally had to say, "It was the Quran." He says, "What are you doing?" And he hit his sister very violently in the head and brought blood out of her ear. down onto her body, and she was very badly hurt. And then he said, give me that, which you were looking at. Omar could read, and he looked at it, and he said, this is beautiful. And he said, I want to be a Muslim. The people were just amazed. They thought that he was going to kill them all. And he looked at the Quran, and he said, and he became a Muslim right on the spot. So then he said, I'm going to go to your leader, and I'm going to testify that I am one of you. Because to this day, always a Muslim has to hear the testimony of a convert so that it's witnessed. And then it's a social, it's a communal act. And so Omar went to the house where Muhammad and some of his followers were. And there was another very tough guy who had become a Muslim who was looking through a crack in the door and said, Omar is coming. He's got his sword. And Muhammad said, all right, let him come in and see what he wants. If he starts any trouble, we'll kill him with his own sword. And so Omar came in, and Hamza, who was the strong man at the door, wanting to protect his master, was about to do something when Muhammad himself flew across the room, grabbed the huge Omar by the scruff of the neck, you might say, or by the garment, and dragged him across the floor violently. And Omar said, what are you doing? I was just going to become a Muslim. And then Muhammad had said, let go of him, and rejoiced, and you could hear his voice booming all over the house in the neighborhood. And so that was the greatest gift or grace of God, they believe, that Omar became one of them. Well, Omar would now and then come into Muhammad's house after knocking and giving the salamu alaikum, peace be on you, and he would be invited in. And the women would be in there, and they'd be chatting and gossiping and chirping and having a lot of fun and laughing and so on. And Muhammad would be sitting in the midst of them, and Omar would say, quiet, you women! This is the Prophet of God in here, and you prattle on. How can you talk in his exalted presence? And Muhammad wouldn't say anything. He'd just kind of sit there. And the women were silent until Omar finished his business and would leave. And then the women would start up again. And Muhammad would just have a slight smile. He apparently never reproved anybody. Always explained things very carefully. The tradition is he always said everything three times. Very calmly. But he was quite a remarkable person. He had total of, I guess it was 11 wives and a couple of concubines. Virtually every wife was a wife contracted because of the need to unite factions and the need to provide for defenseless widows who would not have any status or any security without him. He did not necessarily have intimate relations with all of his wives, but he did give them the status. The Quran says that every person, every male, may have up to four wives concurrently if you can provide for them equally, which many lawyers regard as a practical impossibility, and I would agree. But Muhammad was given a special dispensation to marry more than four because of his unusual situation, and the fact that a lot of men were being killed in various battles, and there was a superfluity of women. But anyway, his young wife, Aisha, who was much younger, he betrothed her when she was hardly a teenager, married her some years later. He would play dolls with her when he was head of the Ummah. And he would sometimes stand in front of their house so that Aisha could peek between here and watch the Abyssinian guard playing their dangerous martial games with their spears, because she loved to see these strong men throwing their spears and sparring with each other. And women aren't supposed to watch that. In many societies, women cannot watch martial arts or touch weapons or anything like that because of taboo systems, and it was that. But Muhammad used to let her do it because he knew that she loved to do it. She got a kick out of it. And she related, she said, and how long do you think a young girl intent on such sights would require her husband to stand there, shielding her? So, because she couldn't be looked at either, because she's the wife of the Prophet, and we have the traditional Near Eastern veiling, or at least setting aside of women. She used to run foot races with her husband. That must have been funny. She said that he would always beat me when I was fat, but when I was thin, I could beat him. And there are many, many wonderful anecdotes about Muhammad. His teeth were gat teeth, which is often a mark of an unusual individual, according to Arabian society. He had good hair on his chest. He was blockish, very strong. When he walked, it was as if he were walking uphill, they said. So he was very determined. He would walk like this. He had beautiful black hair. His skin was not too dark, nor was it too light. He had beautiful eyes. And when he addressed somebody or answered somebody, he always turned his whole body. He had what Gabriel Marcel liked to call présence, presence. He was with you. And that's the way he struck people. He really was with them, boy, girl, man or woman, friend or enemy. He had a high sense of responsibility as a soldier. It was the word of God that the idolaters, if they did not embrace Islam, were to be hunted down and killed. And many were. Not the Jews and the Christians, but the idolatrous Meccans, okay, and others in the tribes. Once they were out on campaign, and one of his able followers, a field grade officer, chased a known idolater into a box canyon and came up to him and was about to kill him when the idolater said, La ilaha illallah, there is no God but Allah, which of course immediately makes one a Muslim. But he killed him anyway. And then he went back to camp, and that night Muhammad summoned him to his headquarters and said, is this story true? He recounted it. I heard this report about you today. He said, oh, prophet of God, this man was not sincere. Did he say, La ilaha illallah, wa Muhammad Rasulullah? And Muhammad is the messenger of God? Yeah, but you know, he didn't mean it. He wasn't sincere. Ah, and I see that you did not hesitate to open up his breast to find whether he was sincere. That is, he stabbed him in the chest with a spear. He said, how are you going to account to our Lord on Judgment Day for that man's La ilaha illallah? And this has been a remarkable trait of always giving one the benefit of the doubt when that person says he or she is a believer. You may not believe it morally, but do listen. Take that person's testimony because it's God who listens. I find this to be a remarkable testimony to the kind of wisdom that he had.